Solar PV Cast by Shift, a podcast exploring solar energy and the role it plays in improving our lives and our planet. Here's your host, Chris Palliser.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Solar PV Cast. My name is Chris. It is brought to you by Shift for all your solar and energy storage needs. Visit shift.ca. Now on the podcast, we've talked about agrivoltaics before. This is very exciting. It's essentially animals and plants living in a symbiotic relationship with solar panels at a solar farm. And I read a recent study a couple months ago that caught my eye about agrivoltaics. Not this time on sheep, which is what we covered before. Apparently sheep are happier. Check that episode out another time. We're talking about insects. Apparently insects thrive at solar farms. And this isn't just something that somebody went out and counted in a field and said, yeah, there's lots of insects. This was a five-year study. So I'm really excited to be chatting to the person behind that study, one of the people behind that study, the author, from the National or Argonne National Laboratory, Argonne landscape ecologist and environmental scientist and department head, Lee Walston. Thanks for joining the podcast, Lee.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, appreciate the time. So quickly, if you could just surmise what the Argonne National Laboratory is about and what you do there.
Yeah, happy to. So Argonne, we're a federally funded research institution operated for the Department of Energy. So we do a lot of research and a lot of work on various energy-related topics. My job over the last few years is sort of focused on utility-scale solar, large-scale solar, all under the umbrella of trying to make solar or try to see how we can make solar more environmentally compatible. One of the projects that we've been working on over the last few years, which you touched on there, was the Inspire project, where we've looked at several solar projects, several solar facilities, and how different vegetation practices at those facilities might contribute to biodiversity conservation. And so that was sort of the nexus behind and the impetus behind that research study that you pointed out. Yeah.
And this is important because, you know, there are many positives around solar that outweigh the negatives, but there are some negatives. And this is one way to address that, because everyone says, well, you need to take up a lot of space. You need to take up a lot of farmland. And this is obviously one way to address that.
Exactly. Yeah. So you hit the nail right on the head there. One of the issues with solar is the land use capacity. Like, it occupies a large footprint relative to other energy land uses. And so one way to sort of address that is to look at dual land uses. So the concept of dual land uses with solar is really growing. Agrivoltaics, as you pointed out, is probably one of the more popular forms of dual land use at solar sites. It's really just the co-location of PV solar and any kind of agricultural practice, whether it's growing crops under and between the solar arrays or livestock grazing, like you mentioned. A lot of sheep grazing has really become popularized at solar sites now. And there's sort of a third bucket of agrivoltaics, and that is habitat enhancement at these sites, which is probably the most adopted form of agrivoltaics, is the habitat form, just because it's a little bit easier to do. You can do that at scale. You don't need sheep, although sheep do help. Maybe we can talk about that. Cropping does not necessarily need all the machinery and the equipment as cropping, although that has come a long ways as well, and it's just a matter of time before you see more cropping designs at PV solar sites. So habitat enhancement, in rural settings can have an agricultural impact, which was one of the areas that we focused on in our research. Happy to talk about that. We're really delighted to see that research get published. It's after 5 years of continuous monitoring at a couple solar sites that have been planted with habitat. We essentially asked that Field of Dreams question, if you build it, will they come? Will you see that biodiversity response? And biodiversity response meaning, do you see an increase in insects, an increase in pollinators over time with the establishment of that vegetation?
And resounding success from what I read in the article. I mean, a lot of work went into this, like you mentioned, 5 years, mm-hmm. and insects are thriving, correct?
They're doing quite well. We started with basically ground zero, and so there was really only one way to go. And so we sort of knew how the script was going to go, or we had a good hypothesis, I should say, on how the script was going to go, because we were starting at former ag sites. So all of these solar sites that we studied were formerly row crop agriculture, which was, you know, tilled and, you know, disturbed year over year for food production, for good reason, for food production. But then they were converted to solar facilities in 2017 was when they were installed for solar facilities, and they were planted with pollinator friendly vegetation and with a mixture of natives and clover and all sorts of pollinator friendly vegetation. They were planted in 2018. And so we came in beginning in 2018 and we're sort of asking the question, well, first of all, how quickly does the vegetation establish? That was one fundamental question that really nobody's really been able to address at solar sites specifically. So we wanted to ask that question, you know, how quickly does the vegetation establish? And then after that, you know, how quickly or how in parallel does the insect pollinators respond? And overall, you know, we conducted this study from 2018 to 2022. And overall, we saw year over year increases in the number of plants that were established and the flowering resources that were being established at these sites. And then in turn, year over year, we also saw increases in insect abundance, all sorts of insects ranging from your natural predators like beetles and some of the flies, some species of flies, all the way up to some more of your more iconic pollinators like native bumblebees, for example. We saw increases in all of those.
Incredible. And we need more bumblebees in this world. We know that for sure. Did you have like a control field with no panels to kind of compare to see how they did?
Well, we sort of used year one as our control. So we're basically tracking things over time and comparing what we saw in 2022 to what we saw in 2018. In 2018, we've got plenty of photographs that show that in 2018, the entire solar site was pretty much dominated by grasses. They were not flowering very much at all. And then over time, you know, 2019, we saw a few flowers. 2020, we saw a lot. And then it sort of, you know, started taking off from there. And so we didn't really have an absolute control field throughout all 4 years of the study. But we sort of used our, you know, year one as sort of our benchmark for things as they progressed. Current research, so we are still conducting this research and looking at different vegetation types on the solar sites. And in that current research that we're underway with, we are using some traditional control fields that are grassland and have always been grassland and, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah.
Very cool. And I'm picturing like a Pixar movie in the making here, I feel like, under these solar panels, having the bumblebees and the beetles all playing together. And there's many bonuses to this, not only in the solar farm field there's incredible biodiversity, but the ripple effects of the fields around it. I was reading the article about like a soy field is benefiting kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So that was one of the questions we wanted to answer in this study was, not only do we see on-site benefits, but is there the possibility for off-site lands to benefit as well? And so one thing about these solar sites, at least in the Midwest, is the solar sites are surrounded by other row crop agricultural fields. And many of them are soybean fields, which soybeans are not traditionally known to be pollinator dependent, but there's some research and literature out there suggesting that pollinators do help. Pollinators do help soybean yields a little bit, even though they're not traditionally known to be pollinator dependent. And so with that in mind, we wanted to sample in some of these nearby soybean fields that are still soybean fields, but they're just close to the solar sites that have been planted with habitat. And over time, we found that, yeah, spillover effect is from the solar sites into the soybean fields is greater. So we actually saw greater numbers of pollinators in the soybean fields visiting soybean flowers closer to the solar facilities where that habitat was planted and restored, as compared to soybean fields that were farther away from the solar facilities, or soybean fields that were more interior, meaning they were not anywhere close to any field edges or close to the solar facilities at all. So that told us that, you know, these solar facilities could act as sources for pollinators that could then also migrate offsite to some of these adjacent farm fields and help pollinate those crops.
Amazing. And just to confirm, this was in Minnesota where the study took place?
Correct. It was Minnesota.
Okay. Yeah, I was reading too that I think something like 10 million acres of land is going to be needed by 2050 for solar generation, just to diversify the energy portfolio. And so
that's right.
There's no question we need the land. This is all about how we can maximize the land and how it corresponds into that boom with solar.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. 10 million acres. That's roughly the amount of land that the Department of Energy has projected needed by 2050 in order to meet decarbonization goals. That 10 million acres, it sounds like that's a lot, but there's a lot of agricultural land and a lot of other previously disturbed, formerly used lands that are out there that, you know, could be suitable for solar that would allow for practices such as this, such as pollinator habitat enhancement at solar sites to be compatible and allow these sites to be multifunctional, right? These dual uses that would help allow solar to be better integrated in these existing landscapes, right? And that's the whole purpose behind this entire study, is to see how feasible that is, demonstrate that it's feasible, at least in Minnesota, demonstrate its feasibility, and show how this can be done possibly in other regions. Other regions, you know, have different soil types, different climates, different agricultural practices in the region. And so we obviously don't expect, you know, this one size fits all kind of thing to solar and habitat. But the concept is largely the same. Figuring out what native and non-native, but what might be the most appropriate seed mixes for that region, developing management strategies for that vegetation, and figuring out how to optimize that vegetation strategy with the pollinator community that might be present at that site, again, to optimize those biodiversity benefits and possibly the services that could be provided to offsite agriculture.
It's incredible. I mean, multiple uses for one thing is the goal in everything we do. And so, you know, it's so wonderful to hear that this research is happening, because it's not just we're putting solar panels on a field and we're moving on. We're trying to dig even deeper, literally, and plant some things. And you mentioned previously disturbed land. So how is the selection process when they put in a solar farm? They're obviously not going to go to some farmer who's producing food, which we obviously need, especially as with inflation and the cost of food. So how do they select where the solar farm goes? And then, you know, I guess, how does the study play into that?
That's a really good question. And for research scientists like me, that's something that we haven't been able to really answer. There might be some other decisions and some other factors that, you know, we haven't been able to really understand, but those are the optimum places from an ecological point of view. From an ecological point of view, the best places to site solar or any development for that matter are previously disturbed lands, right? Because those are going to be areas that are already ecologically compromised.
Right.
And so you would expect then that the impacts of construction and operation of that facility would not be as severe, theoretically, would not be as severe as siting that project in a native forest or a prairie system those kinds of things. So from an ecological point of view, the most important part of solar development, first and foremost, is siting, having these projects sited on sited appropriately on previously used disturbed lands. The factors behind those decisions, those are sort of out of our research domain and out of our area of specialty.
Yeah.
But you can imagine that probably economics come into play, that land prices, there might be some cost behind, some calculation behind the scenes on what might be more productive for a farmer, to maybe divvy up part of their land for, keeping some of that land still in agricultural production, then maybe divvying up a portion of that land for solar development. Those calculations eventually may have come out to some agreement to allow solar development on those formerly agricultural lands.
Well, and it makes sense now too because of those ripple effects of the bonus. So maybe you do have a large plot of land. You've got some previously disturbed land, so it's already been compromised, as you said. So you put a solar farm in the middle of it. And guess what? All of that agricultural land around you is going to produce even more.
Absolutely. And most of these solar developments are not outright purchased from the farmer, from the landowner. They are leases, implying that after a certain amount of time, maybe 20 or 30 years over the life of a solar lease, that land can be returned back to the farmer and put back into agricultural production. 20 to 30 years of habitat enhancement on the site could do a lot of great benefits to improve soil health, which could then later on down the road, once it's converted back to agricultural production, increase that production even more. So there are a lot of on-site and off-site benefits for the farming community with solar. But of course, 20 to 30 years of solar would also mean that, some of the more direct agricultural practices on that land would maybe not be compatible, although there are some cropping agrivoltaics concepts and strategies that are being implemented and currently under research that it's just a matter of time before we start to see more of those ideas scale up and be more readily implemented. But you're right. Solar energy development in these agricultural landscapes can really help both offsite farmers and the farmers that are leasing their land to solar companies for future crop production.
The future is now. The Solar PV Cast by Shift.
Right now in Alberta, in Canada, they had a moratorium on large solar farms and installations because the farmers were concerned what's going to happen to the field in 25, 30 years when the lease is up and the panels aren't producing as much. So this study truly does play into that. Like you said, spend all that time enriching that soil, produce a ton of clean energy, and then at the end, if you decide to get the field back and all of a sudden, you're right, it's going to have this incredibly rich soil and diversity in that area.
Right, right. So there's research underway right now to help develop frameworks to measure and quantify soil health and how carbon gets stored in soils at solar sites so that can be tracked over time to see how, at the end of a solar lease, for example, how much carbon has been sequestered in these soils at the solar sites over time. So there's already research underway to try to help understand how these solar sites are contributing to soil health. But that is critical to successful farming is having good healthy soils, and that's certainly one way that solar sites can help.
Yeah, that's incredible. What do you enjoy most about doing this research and learning these things as you go in your everyday life?
One exciting thing about this kind of research is it's so new and it's changing so quickly. The term solar pollinator habitat or solar habitat friendly solar, I don't think that was even a word, 5, 6, 7 years ago, 8 years ago. I mean, things have happened just so quickly in just the last 5 years. the world of agrivoltaics has really taken off more than just a little concept to now things that are in practice where strategies and solar companies are working with farmers and producers to optimize crop production at solar facilities. So the whole world of agrivoltaics is so new and it's rapidly evolving. And so I like it because of that, it's sort of, it's new and emerging. Oops, sorry, my thumb slipped there. But yeah, it's a great, fast-paced field that has been really exciting to work in. And I, as an ecologist, I really enjoy the habitat side of things and seeing what how habitat matures and what is looking at habitat enhancement at solar facilities from a possibility standpoint to a realistic standpoint. There's a spectrum there where solar facilities are, they are well intentioned and they provide a lot of habitat. Some facilities might be able to provide, really high diverse, high growing seed mixes. Other facilities, maybe because their panels are closer to the ground or maybe because the panels are really close together. There are some realities with some solar facilities that might not allow them to plant the most optimum seed mix, right? But they're still able to do something. They're still able to maybe plant a general seed mix that still allows some floral resources to establish at the solar site that can still provide some sort of net benefit to biodiversity. That's still a benefit. That's still good. That's still better than the alternative, mm-hmm. right? Which the alternative, ecologically speaking, was not very much. The alternative was row crop agriculture, which was the previous land use. So we tend to look at things along that gradient where there are some solar sites that, for they're raised high off the ground. The panels are elevated off the ground. They're able to do a lot more. And they're able to plant a very diverse seed mix that also requires maybe a little bit more management. So there's also some management that's involved with mowing and making sure, invasive species are kept at bay, those kinds of things. And so things are sort of along a spectrum. And what we're starting to see is, depending on siting and how the projects are sited, even projects that are, sort of planting low diversity, low growing seed mixes are still seeing net positive biodiversity benefits in these pollinator plantings on their solar sites. So I really enjoy seeing that and seeing how all the different I won't say options, but the different the constraints and the realizations at solar sites kind of play out in terms of what can be planted, what gets established, and what kinds of ecological outcomes can we see at these sites. Sorry, that was a really long-winded answer.
No, you can tell you enjoy what you do, and I love that. And honestly, it's all positive. It all has a positive light on it. And you said, something is better than nothing, especially compared to the alternative of mining or anything like that.
Exactly. We kind of keep it in that context. For sites that were constructed, for solar facilities that were constructed on ecologically valuable land, let's say a forest was completely cut down in order to make way for a solar facility, there the bar might have been raised pretty high, right? You raise the bar because you took down something that was of ecological value. In order to offset those impacts, that bar has been raised, that ecological bar has been raised. But at many solar sites where you're looking at, former ag land, former disturbed lands, that ecological bar to start has been lowered so much so that it does not take much to, or in theory, I should say, it does not take much to see these biodiversity gains. And that's really what we saw in the outcomes of this study that we published was, their former ag lands, former ag fields, they offered very little value to begin with. So what if they were now planted with solar panels, they're planted with solar panels and they're planted with, native habitat. What do we see? And we saw a good response in the vegetation that established. Many of the flowering plant species, that were planted, bloomed within the first 3 years. We saw them come back in the first 3 years after they were planted. And in turn, we also saw the pollinators, especially those native bees. Those native bees did a really good job of coming back and showing up on those flowers. And so, whether it's high diverse, highly, tall growing native plant species, or whether it's a low diverse, plant mix, it all comes back to siting. And, I think, it's, if you build it, yes, they will come. You will see a positive response in the pollinator community as a result.
That's great. Not to mention these fields are also producing clean energy. Like there's so many benefits here. Yeah. How did you count the bugs? Or know what I mean? How does that? I'm just trying to wrap around that.
That's a good question. So we set up transects. And these transects were 100 feet long. And so we set up a number of transects at every solar facility. And we just walked each transect at a pace that would get us through the transect in about 5 minutes. So these are about 5 minute walks in several. So we did several 5 minute walks around the solar sites. And we just counted the number of pollinators that we saw. So it was sort of like just taking tally of the number of different pollinators we saw. So we didn't collect. We didn't collect or touch any of the pollinators. It was all observational, and we just took count of all the ones that we saw. As you might expect, in the early years, when there were no flowers, nothing was flowering. It was pretty simple. There were a lot of low numbers. There weren't zeros. There were many times where we actually saw pollinators, even when there weren't very many flowering resources. There wasn't much flowering. We still saw pollinators, but those numbers definitely increased, and we were definitely busy scribbling our tally marks in the later years when there were a lot of things flowering, and we did see a lot of pollinators. Yeah, one other thing that we saw is there's been such an emphasis on the decline of the monarch butterfly lately. Over time at these solar sites, we also saw. And this was not published in our study. This is sort of anecdotal, but we also have some empirical data on this that we're going to try to publish. But we saw some increases in milkweed, the host plant for monarch butterfly. We saw increased abundance of milkweed at these solar sites over time. And as a result, we also saw increased numbers of monarch butterflies at these sites over time. So a very specific type of pollinator that we don't really get into in that study that was mentioned here, but just sort of anecdotally, and also we do have some data to support this that we're working on, but it's just one other example that even specific species that might be of conservation concern, like the monarch butterfly, could see some benefits from this kind of habitat approach.
Incredible. And because you are doing the seeding, you can kind of plan that. Now that you've got some basic knowledge here, you can say, monarchs are struggling. I've got a way we can help them.
Right. Exactly. Yep. And some of these milkweed species, they are appropriately named milkweed because they grow pretty well. There are some species of milkweed, like common milkweed, for example, that we had show up in some of our sites, even if they were not planted with milkweed. They were able to retain in the seed bank, or they were blown in from other offsite areas. Milkweed seeds are often wind blown, and so we saw a great proliferation of milkweed at many of our sites that we surveyed in the Midwest. And it just goes to show that if you take some measures to allow habitat to establish, things sort of naturally come back, right? Milkweed is one, well, not always, but milkweed is a good example of in some cases where it's able to come back, especially in these agricultural landscapes. And it might be a benefit for pollinators such as monarch butterflies.
That's great. What's the feedback been like, from the laboratory, from your colleagues, and from the public with the study being published?
It's been overall positive. We do get a lot of questions about how feasible is this in other regions, like in the Southwest, or in the South, or in the Northeast. It looks like it makes sense, or at least our example study makes sense in the Midwest. But how applicable is, solar and habitat in other regions? And we do have Well, I'm aware of other research that's being undertaken in other regions that are looking at the feasibility of different vegetation types and the how different vegetation types grow at solar facilities in other regions. And I think it's something promising. The look and the feel and the implementation of solar habitat might not be the same in every region. In the West, for example, where it's more arid and vegetation takes longer to grow. It might take a little bit longer for habitat to establish in Western systems. In other regions, we might be looking at different types of seed mixes, maybe more wet dominated seed mixes rather than upland dominated seed mixes, those kinds of things. And so it's really important to understand the soils and the characteristics of the seed mixes for that region and select seed mixes that are appropriate for that region. But I think I'm optimistic. I think there is a working solution for solar sites in almost every region that will enhance habitat for that region. Now, it might not result in a 10 out of 10, perfectly optimal habitat type for that region. In the Midwest, for example, the Midwest is prairie country, right? We're talking about lands that have been historically converted from prairie to row crop agriculture. Now we're taking that row crop agriculture, putting in a solar, and we're putting habitat on that. Should we make that solar habitat as functional as a restored prairie, right? Essentially asking, should solar companies be restoring back to native prairie? I don't think that that's really what we're trying to get at here, nor is that really, what solar companies, the solar industry needs to do. Solar industry should not be restoring prairies, but
Totally.
if they can restore some habitat to a certain level, what is that level? Your guess is as good to mine. Something better than zero, right? Something is better than nothing, right? If they can do something to restore habitat somewhere in there that's better than the alternative, that's kind of what we're striving for, right? And so that's kind of where we're thinking about things. It's great if solar companies can, restore habitat to greater levels, maybe levels that resemble prairie habitats, restored prairie habitats, but we just got to, kind of keep in mind, sort of the perspectives and the context behind all of these things that, maybe solar pollinator habitat is working very well at a certain functional level. And if all solar sites functioned at that ecological level in terms of habitat provision, it would be a tremendous, I believe, a tremendous amount of biodiversity uplift compared to what they were offering previously in the previous land use.
Well, and that's exactly it. I think you got to look at the big picture with it all. Compared
Right.
to what you've said a few times, better than the alternative, this is so much better than the other ways we got our energy, and we took it from the earth. You know what I mean? So.
Exactly. And in a way, it's sort of a no-brainer. I mean, if you think about it, you say, okay, going from an agricultural field to a solar field with some wildflowers. Yeah, no brainer. It's gonna do better than, but really there hasn't been any research or anything collected to really demonstrate that. So some of these foundational studies that demonstrate that are really important. I would say we still need more. We need more studies that show how this can be done and what this might look like in different regions, right? So
Yeah.
it's
Well,
all really, yeah.
it's all really positive. And honestly, like you said, 5 years ago, agrivoltaics wasn't a thing. So the
Right.
fact that it's this new and yet it still is so obvious that it's a good thing, like, 50 years ago when they were mining for oil or putting oil derricks in, they weren't 5 years into it thinking, how can we grow wildflowers around these oil derricks?
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so
So.
it's all changing, and yeah, it's really exciting. There's a lot of exciting research that's underway right now across the country. Yeah, it's great.
I think it's wonderful that we're looking at this and we're having these conversations and we're being mindful. And I think it's so great that everyone who's looking at renewable energy, obviously from an economy standpoint, it makes a lot of sense, which is why it's booming. But I think it's wonderful that people that are renewable energy minded are also those that are caring for the planet and looking
right.
how to do better. And so when you approach it in this manner of how can we do better, I think this is wonderful. And it's wonderful to hear, as you mentioned, that the solar companies are on board.
Mm-hmm. Yep. At 100%. Every solar company that we talk to, they're very much interested in providing habitat. It's you know, by virtue of being in the renewable energy sector, right? There's this interest. And so that's great to see. There is a passion to do better. You know, like all other forms of energy and industry, you know, there is sort of a bottom line. And so that bottom line kind of helps us understand, okay, what is the best we can do with this bottom line, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much for chatting with us about this article. I'm going to share the link with the podcast, and I think it's all good news. Honestly, it's the future is bright. Not to make a corny solar joke there, but you know, the birds and the I think there's some joke about the birds and the bees and the solar, and there's something in there.
Yeah.
But it's all good news. Lee Walston is an ecologist and scientist with the Argonne National Laboratory. They just released a study on how insects and bugs and habitat biodiversity is thriving in solar fields. And that's what we've been chatting about on the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time today to chat with us, Lee.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. Thank you for having me.
The Solar PV Cast by Shift with Chris Palliser. To begin your solar journey, visit shift.ca.